Today, on the Nerd Outcast podcast, winter is coming. We're going to be discussing A Game of Thrones. Specifically, we will be discussing the first book in the Song of Ice and Fire, written by George R. R. Martin, and we'll also be talking about the first season of the show. The huge, crazy, popular fantasy. Political fantasy? I've heard someone describe this as a political fantasy, so that may not be too inaccurate. I am your host, Chris Bashan, and like I said, I brought on some experts who feel they can speak with some authority about this topic. My first expert has been on before. He's all the way over in New York, and his name is...
Tom Brown.
Hey, Tom. How you doing?
Hey, Chris. I'm good. How are you?
I'm pretty good, dude. So, just in case someone is talking to you for the first time, or listening to you for the first time, what type of nerd are you? Specifically, what do you typically read? Who are some of your favorite authors and... Yeah.
Well, let's see. I really love science fiction, fantasy, so genre is like really what I read a lot of. I read all of the George R. R. Martin books, but just like to go through some of my favorite authors. I mean, Stephen King, I mean, Asimov, of course. Greg Bear, I love him. He's a great sci-fi fantasy writer. He wrote a book called... similarly titled, The Song of like Power and... Infinity or something like that.
Okay.
And it's a two-book series, and I really recommend it. That might not be the name, but you should be able to find it if you look up Greg Bear. Anyway, he's one of my favorite authors. Ken Follett, like him. Not science fiction at all, but, like, you know, his books are great.
Cool. And where does Song of Ice and Fire fall for you? Where does this series... Is it one of your favorite series? Like, how would you rate it?
It really is. I got into the series in like 2006. So when I started, it was still not a television show, and I really enjoyed it. And despite the long wait between books, you know, waiting for 4 and 5 was really long. I really enjoyed it. I stuck with the characters. He developed a really strong connection with the characters, and we'll get into like my favorite things about his writing, but. I think that was it. Like, because each chapter is literally titled after one of the characters, you know, live in that character's headspace and you get really invested with them.
Okay, cool. Well, hold on to your other thoughts and feelings. We'll discuss them very shortly. My other experts, one of them is over in Virginia, and his name is
Pete Foose.
Hey, Pete.
Hey, Chris. How you doing?
I'm doing pretty good. How are you, my friend?
Doing all right.
So, similar question to you. What are some of your favorite authors, and ultimately, where does this series of books rank for you?
Well, as far as favorite authors go, I love Neil Gaiman. Terry Pratchett are two of my absolute favorites. I also get into the mysteries and psychothrillers like James Patterson. And I also get into, you know, classics. You know, I read Anna Karenina recently, which is a long but very interesting book.
Cool. And where does Game of Thrones rank for you?
Game of Thrones, I quickly got an obsession with it once I finally got into it. I had a stutter start of getting into it. It took a while. But once I did, I went full bore, and I really just chewed it up. I love all the mythology of this entire world of Westeros. I love it.
And surprise question just for you, Pete. Are you more of a science fiction guy, or are you a fantasy guy?
I have to say I am more of a science fiction guy.
Okay.
I do love it, but I like the science fantasy stuff. I like the, you know, the space operas like Star Wars and Battlestar Galactica, which really don't have much of a basis in science, but are still you know, called science fiction. They're science fantasies. I love those.
Cool. All right. Well, hold on to your thoughts about Game of Thrones. We'll come back to them very shortly. My next expert, he is here in Chicago, and he's just a few blocks away, and his name is...
Rob Shoemate.
Hey, Rob.
Hey.
Same question to you. You've been on the podcast before, but what type of literature do you delve into, and where does Game of Thrones rank for you?
I'll read pretty much anything. I just did a tear through all the Dresden novels over the last year and a half. Terry Pratchett, Neil Gaiman, huge fans of. In fact, I think, Pete, you were on the Neil Gaiman podcast too, right?
Yes, I was.
Yeah, that was a good one. But yeah, I'll read anything. I've even read history, so I mean, it's throw something at me. You think I like it? I'll read it.
Okay. And what about Game of Thrones? Where does this rank for you?
It would be higher in my rankings if it would come out a little more regularly.
Okay.
The frustration I have with Mr. Martin putting books out because he likes football and whatnot is really starting to degrade my loving of the books.
Okay.
But I would put them in my top 20.
Okay, great. Well, hold on. We'll go into a deeper analysis of all of that. My listeners, those are my experts, as is typical for this podcast. I've brought on one outcast and a pseudo-outcast to talk perhaps against the Song of Ice and Fire. He's sitting in the room with me, and his name is...
Mark Soloff.
Hi, Mark.
Hi, Chris.
How are you doing?
I'm good.
So, I don't know if this is the first time we've had you on a literature podcast.
Oh.
So what type of literature do you read? Do you read? Can you read? You can read, right?
I can look at shapes and figure out the sound they make.
Okay.
So here's the thing. Let me tell you a little bit about my secret origins. I went to grad school, and I had to do so much reading in grad school. This was about 10 years ago. That afterwards, I just did not want to read anything ever. And so while I consider myself a fan of written science fiction and fantasy, honestly, I haven't been doing a ton of consumption of these intellectual properties for a while. So, like, I mean, I am a fan of William Gibson's work, but I haven't read one of his books in several years. I consider myself a Stephen King fan,
okay,
but similarly haven't read much of his stuff lately.
Ray Bradbury.
I have only read his book on writing, which is a series of, like, essays.
Okay.
And in fact, in the past 5 years or so, I gravitate more towards, like, books about craft, you know, like, okay, writing or...
acting.
Acting or, like, Buddhist philosophy type stuff, which is not to say I prefer that to fantasy, but I guess it's what I need right now.
Okay.
And, like, my fantasy life is more in movies and video games and TV. But okay. I did read Game of Thrones, the first one, 7 months ago.
Okay. Have you read Lord of the Rings or Harry Potter?
I read all the Harry Potters.
Okay.
I read the first Lord of the Rings book.
Okay. So you are my outcast.
Yeah.
So why are you my outcast?
Well...
There's probably a few different reasons. We don't have to go into a great detail right now, but I'm just kind of curious. I'm just trying to take a temperature reading about your opinion on George R. R. Martin.
Yeah.
Or Game of Thrones.
You could call me an outcast because I felt swindled after I read the first book. I was introduced first to the TV series, okay, and then I was like, oh, I should read the books and find out what happens. I read the first book, and I plowed through it. And then at the end, I felt that there was no satisfying resolution. And people are like, oh, yeah, that's part of it, man. Like, you never get the resolution. Like, we're still not done with these characters' stories. And I feel like that's fine to build a massive universe. But I think within each book, there should be a narrative structure that has a conclusion that satisfies. If anything, the first book was, like, prologue to what is going to happen in the real story.
What about the lack of resolution in the show? Like, did that bother you?
No. I feel like the show, because it's chopped into episodes, And you meet these new characters. You don't, like, when you read about the tournament and you get introduced to all the different knights and all their names and backgrounds, like, you don't know whether they're going to be important characters or just set dressing. Mm-hmm. And so my mind is creating faces and trying to distinguish between them. But if you're watching a television show, it's just, oh, those guys are extras, you know, and you can you don't have to spend the mental energy or emotional investment. But with the book, I was never sure what to focus in on and what to retain and what to just breeze past. And so I found it very frustrating when you go into detail about these characters that wouldn't show up again or that show up again, you know, books and books later.
Okay. You have thrown the gauntlet down, sir.
Yes, I've thrown this game's gauntlet.
I appreciate that. So hopefully... my experts and I will be able to address some of that. I'm also a pseudo outcast on this because I did read the first book. I've actually read the first few books, and I don't think George R. R. Martin is really that fantastic of a writer. I really don't. I think he's got some serious issues, and I will. You know what? We'll talk about that later because I want to pose that question to all of you. So. There you go, my outcasts. Mark feels like he was swindled. And George R. R. Martin needs to give him $11.97 back.
Heck yeah. Plus interest.
So let's talk a little bit about George R. R. Martin first before we start talking about Game of Thrones. So Martin as a writer, can anybody speak to perhaps what are some of the calling cards of him as a writer? Is he, you know, is he a good writer? Is he a bad writer? Is he better than Tolkien? What do you guys think?
I think he's better than Tolkien, but... because
that's not too
dear
hard.
God, that's a hard read. But no, he's really good at characterization and characters in general.
Yeah.
And I think that also might be one of his failings because he just introduces, and like I think because Mark, you know, you touched on this, he introduces so many characters that you think are going to be integral to the plot and just end up not being. They end up being throwaway characters, or like you said, later on, they become more integral to the plot. I think that's why I kind of like the television show just a little bit more, because they do water it down, they do filter it for you. But again, with like, some of the characters, I will go to bat for him, Tyrion, Eddard Stark, most of the Starks in general. I love reading about them, so...
Okay. Can I say something about this point that, you know, you get to know characters and then you don't necessarily need to know them? I mean,
fire away.
You learn this in the prologue of the first book. I mean, you get to know three people who are dead at the end of the chapter. They're all dead.
Yeah.
And you're like, oh, okay. Doesn't that kind of clue you into what the rest of the book and, in fact, series will put you through? I mean, come on.
Yeah.
To answer. Oh.
I'm sorry, I'm actually going to defend you, Mark.
Good man.
I think that you can keep it more to the main character, and he keeps adding new characters, and I understand that some of them are really worth it. Some of them I just don't give a rat's ass about. And I think he's getting too big with it, and I think he's going to have a problem wrapping up storylines into books.
There's a big spoiler, and warning listeners, we will spoil the first book in season. There's a big spoiler I want to talk about later on that kind of relates to investing in characters and then them dying, so you're not really sure who to invest in. Tom, I remember that prologue at the beginning with the three guys who go out looking for the White Walkers and whatnot, and I remember he spent a lot of time describing the one guy who was like rich or was a prince and was kind of a dick and really shouldn't have been in command.
Yeah.
And then, of course, these three guys get killed, and you never see them again.
That's not true.
Well, you
Eddard
see, one
Stark
of them
beheads
one of them,
the one.
Right.
That's the one he beheads.
One
and
gets
makes
away.
His children
yeah.
watch.
Yes.
The
yes.
one of them gets away. So, like,
because he's a good father.
But then that guy's dead a few chapters later.
Right.
The next chapter. Very next chapter.
So let's talk about the issue that we're kind of drifting around. How do you feel he's ripping people off by asking you to invest in everybody and then just killing them off, or like where is that payoff for that?
I just feel like it's, well, the payoff, I mean, that's a good question. I feel like he's putting you through a different book experience than what, well, what I'm used to. I mean, I learned that really quickly in the books, and I learned the lesson again and again. And it's just, I mean, look, these people might die. And it's a really severe world, a harsh world. Also,
My argument.
Wait. To speak to the sloppiness, perhaps, of maybe, you know, like just throwing a bunch of characters up in the air just to see what sticks. I feel like it adds to the confusion that the characters themselves are going through. There's a lot of disinformation. Perhaps a maester writes something on a raven and sends out, and it's not true. It's just what the maester knew at the time. But that information then circulates and causes other unforeseen circumstances. Maybe he was shooting from the hip, but I feel like it's a little bit more realistic than, wow, I can tell that the author really thought this plot line through. J.R. Tolkien. I mean, sorry.
George.
J.K. Rowling is what I'm trying to say. That's J.K. Rowling. Because her plots, like, clearly were spreadsheeted out to the nth degree, whereas I feel like George R.R. Martin, you know, it's a lot more sloppy. You know, it's messy. I don't know that he didn't have it all in mind the whole time, but it feels more realistic anyway.
There are lies that storylines straight for him.
Well, yeah. Yeah, I'm sure it's more than one guy too.
Rob, yeah. you were about to say something.
I did. I said it.
Oh, okay. Pete, you've been quiet. What's going on over there?
Well, as far as how his writing goes, the writing style he chose for Game of Thrones and the whole series of using the limited third person perspective, if you want to get technical, picking a person and seeing their viewpoint, like I think it was Tom said at the very beginning, that structure allows you to get inside the headspace of each character. And knowing more about what that character wants, how that character feels about other people and events going on, adds a reality to it, a tangibility to the world. And as brutal and horrible and severe as the events are, it's the most realistic fantasy novel I've ever read. I can simply see a world where magic petered out and became our world, as vicious and brutal as it is.
You, Tom, I think you were the one who brought up the character-specific point of view for each chapter, which I actually really, really like.
Yeah.
This allows him to create plot lines that are taking place in vastly different areas of the world, as is obvious from the whole Targaryen plot line with Daenerys and her brother. Is that frustrating to see plot lines that are very, very completely separated out?
Oh, yeah. There are times in reading this book series that I got extraordinarily frustrated. I mean, it's book one. I mean, by the end of the book, I was extremely frustrated with the way it ended. I mean, because I cared a lot about these characters, because I'm living in their heads. So I get all of their infirmities. I get all of their, inability to make things go right. Like, so many times Ned Stark could have made his situation better, you know?
And stupid Ned Stark.
Did not, because he was so honorable. It was so frustrating. And then, you know, that combined with little shit Joffrey. I mean, there are characters that are just amazing in this book, though. I mean, Tyrion is one of my favorite characters, absolutely.
I think Tyrion is a lot of people's favorite character.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm.
Rob, Pete, what about you two? Does the disparate plot lines, the actual, like, geography of people being spread out so much bother you? I mean, obviously...
I know we're only talking about book one. It didn't really bug me until... And I actually kind of enjoyed it, because right about the time I would be tired of looking through, like, Jaime's eyes, it would take me back to the Targaryens, you know? Later on, though, specifically book four and five, hated it. Because then, during book five, you have to remember 5 years ago when you were reading book
really
four,
sucked.
What's going on when.
That one really sucked. You had to forget about half of the characters in book four, too, because it only addressed half of the characters in book four. And then
it was
the first
so frustrating.
Three quarters of book five were the other characters, and then they sprinkled in the characters from book four, so it was a little bit less frustrating. But book four and five, you're right. I totally agree. So frustrating.
Yeah, it didn't really bug me until then.
Pete,
in fact, I actually kind of like it.
My final expert. You're taking the third position each time. What do you think?
Well, I just I hear the passion in their voices, and I don't want to jump in ahead of these guys. But no, I'm very passionate about these stories, but I had the luxury of reading all five of the books that are out all at once.
Ugh.
All in one go. And so I didn't have the frustration of waiting. The separated plot line of 4 and 5 is, well, I don't mind waiting because it's all going to be in one, you know, it won't be separate plot lines like 4 and 5. I could see how 4 and 5, if you waited for it, would be awful. Just straight awful. But reading it all together, I was able to keep it in my mind. And then I was able to go back and I read it all again. And it turns out that if you have all that together at once, book 4 ends up being a really strong book with a lot of fantastic events happening in it. And I think there are more important events happening in 4 than there are in 5. But again, we're back to book 1.
Any other ways that the book kind of differentiates itself from what came before? Why are people suddenly talking about this? And obviously there's a hit HBO show on the air that really helps. But the first book came out in the 90s, is that correct?
Yeah.
When did it come 97? Out?
97? 94 or 5, I thought.
Yeah, okay. I remember my roommate reading it back then.
Yeah.
And telling me I should read it and then throwing it across the room when he got to the end of the book.
common reaction to what we'll talk about later.
My God.
Did any of you read this back in the 90s?
No.
Nope.
When did you guys first read it?
I randomly picked it up. A roommate of mine, and a completely different roommate, said her boyfriend had given it to her, and she thought I might like it. And this was in 2004, maybe 2003, and the first three books were already out.
Oh,
book
wow.
4 had not come out yet, yeah.
Okay.
So I got to read 1, 2, and 3 back to back.
Oh, that's a nice little trilogy to read.
Mm.
Tom, Pete, what about you two?
I did the same thing in like 2005 or 6, I can't remember where, but that exact process.
And then Pete had the luxury of reading all 5.
Yes, 2012.
Mm-hmm.
Cool. Well, we've kind of already hinted on it, so let's talk a little bit about the characters. And I guess we'll start at the top with Ned Stark, who I think is probably supposed to be the protagonist or the person that you are rooting for or identifying with, at least in the first book.
Go so far as to say John as well.
He gets a lot of the chapters. If you just go by sheer chapter numbers, Ned gets a great deal of them.
He's also investigating this mystery that kind of, as a reader, you're also investigating, and you're learning things as he's learning them, so that's kind of why I think he might be who you're supposed to identify with the most. Although Jon Snow does get a lot, too. So
yeah.
Mm-hmm.
Well, that's the first real split.
You mean like geography-wise?
Well, no, I mean, yes. Because like you have this family and then Benjen and Jon go to the wall. Yeah, you do have Daenerys and her brother. But this I'm talking about within the story where people start going their separate ways.
Okay.
Yeah, it was a dual plot line, and then at the point when John leaves with Benjen, it starts fracturing.
Yeah,
and then you have more fracturing and more fracturing from there.
Okay, what do you guys want to say about old Ned Stark, played by the wonderful Sean Bean in the TV show?
I do want to say, like, back when this was first coming on, and you hadn't read the books yet, Chris. And I was talking it up to you, and you're like, "Oh, Sean Bean's in it. It means he's going to die in the first third." And I just started laughing.
Yep.
He doesn't sign on for long-term projects. He can't even make it through most of his movies.
He's going to die at the end of the first season of Legends too. No, I love Ned Stark a lot. He's really, really proud, really honorable, and boy, does it bite him in the ass.
You know, he is really proud. He is really honorable. I don't think he's stupid. He just doesn't operate on the same level that Littlefinger.
He's lawful good.
He's very super lawful good. Yeah. Yeah.
He doesn't see a lot of it coming because he's without guile to that extent. I mean, he's not an idiot. You're right. But he just doesn't see just how far they'll go.
Yeah. And it's a product of where he's from. He's not used to the political corruption of King's Landing and gets completely lost in it. He takes everything at face value And yeah.
There is one thing I want to talk about, and this does book jump, but it is in this book where you learn about Ned Stark's bastard, Jon Snow, which seems completely and totally out of character for Ned Stark to have a bastard son.
Suspiciously so.
Right? So, do we all think he's lying?
I don't know. I truly don't know.
I guess we really can't talk about that.
We can't. But in the first book, he does say when they part ways, and it sucks for Jon Snow, but when they part ways at the crossroads, he says to him, "When I see you again at the wall, I will tell you about your mother." And it just the way he said it, you're like, you're not my son. That's what he was saying at the crossroads. You're not my son.
You know, it never really bothered me that he had a bastard, just because it is a harsh world, and it is a very real world. So even though
the way he married Catelyn was kind of not the way you know it was, because his brother died. That's the only reason.
I just figured it that, you know, he was out to war, he met a woman that he loved for a night, you know, or whatnot, or that he had a connection, and then suddenly he had a bastard.
A human being. I mean, he's doing the honorable thing by raising his bastard. I mean, what more can you ask of a guy? Most people would just slaughter their own character.
Especially when he's talking to the king later on, and they're talking about all of the king's conquests, and Robert Braytham keeps bringing up, "Oh, what about this one?" He's like, "No, that was one of yours too." So you just get the feeling that he never actually did.
I don't know.
That's true. It's true. But it is easy to excuse in this world something like that.
I feel that, let's go on and talk about it now. I feel that this is kind of George R. Like, Ned Stark is maybe kind of like Aragorn. Like, he's the righteous fighter. He's a really good fighter, although I think he's physically older, even though Aragorn is like 83 in Lord of the Rings. But he's, you know, a righteous man who has come to hopefully right the wrongs in the capital city. And then he gets killed. Spoiler alert, he gets killed in a very horrible way by a shit little kid. Which is, just imagine if Tolkien had killed Aragorn in The Fellowship of the Ring.
By the order of a little goblin, yeah.
Yeah. And
Wormtongue.
And I remember reading that and thinking, oh, there's no way he's dead. There is no way. And then, you know, by the end of the book, I was like, oh my God, he killed the protagonist. He killed the protagonist. He killed Jenny. He killed the hero.
I think he did that so on purpose to get everyone prepared for what was to come.
Yeah, just deal with it, everybody. This is the way this story goes. No one is
safe. That's right, guys.
No
one is safe. Him, and now he's gone.
Be careful who you love.
So how did you all react to the death of Ned Stark?
I was horrified.
Viscerally.
I was so pissed off.
I had a, I guess, unique experience because I read it earlier this year, and everybody who was getting into the TV show was already saying, oh, ha, 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 Sean Bean, totally dead, ha, ha, ha. So I knew from the beginning that Ned was marked for death. And I was I was spending much of the book kind of wondering, when is it going to come? How is it going to come? At whose hand? It was unpleasant.
Still in pain.
You were spoiled.
Yeah. It was unpleasant, but it wasn't unexpected. Okay. Once he was maimed, like he gets his leg messed up and imprisoned, I was kind of like, all right, this is the end. He's winding down. There's no escape.
It's tough. It's, it still brings a tear to my eye.
What was worse than that was Sansa's whole situation, because she's completely alone and she's now trapped with these motherfuckers. And, you know, you don't like her because she's kind of a little, you know, bitch.
But she doesn't deserve to be where
she is. No, she does not deserve that. And then she quickly realizes, oh, shit, this is my life now and it sucks.
Completely alone.
The only Stark I don't like.
Both Sansa.
She had to see her father's head on a pike.
Both Sansa.
Joffrey showed her.
And her father are trapped by these social mores that they're operating in, where Sansa is like, oh, I'm supposed to be a pretty princess and be well-mannered and polite and giggle and like handsome knights. She's just like trying to live with those expectations. Her sister is like, no, I want to fight and be a badass. I want to be more of a tomboy. And that's like, that's not okay in their society.
Yeah.
But it turns out that the world they live in is so cruel and unsentimental that both Sansa and Ned's sort of systems of conduct are completely incompatible with long life.
Well, Sansa seems to be doing better now.
Yeah. One thing I've noticed, and I don't know if he's trying to make a comment on the real world or whatnot, but, well, let me pose this question. Is the death of Ned Stark, is that the gimmick of the book? Like, is that why people really like the series, because no one is safe?
Dangerous.
Yeah.
I don't know if I would go gimmick, but I think he definitely made you really care about this character and killed him in such a way that it's disgusting physically to me. That I was just... I think it set up the rest of the series going, okay, he's not afraid to kill anyone.
Yeah, and he has a, you know, that kind of is an impressive thing to be able to make you viscerally react that way. Yeah. I reacted the same way.
Exactly.
And that was the intention. So, I mean, that's the bargain he made with us. We accepted, and then he delivered. That's all I'm saying.
Mm-hmm. So when we talk about it this way, I feel it's strange to say that he's not a good writer, because if he's able to make us react this way to this character, and we reacted this way because of the situation that was written, not just because of Sean Bean's performance and the performances of all the other wonderful ensemble cast. This situation was set, and people who read it first had the same reaction as people who saw it in the show first. It's a good story. As pissed off as it makes you, as frustrating as it is, as wild as the plot gets, it's still good enough to make you feel that way.
Yeah, and it's okay. It's not Ned Stark's story because, you know, it's book two. Go on.
Well, I think technically it's no one person's story, as I think. What he's trying to get home. One thing I've noticed, and this is dipping a little later into the series, but this world is a world where stupid, selfish people have all the power. And I
so
wonder,
unlike our world.
Yeah,
I
wonder if that's his comment on our world, because there's a lot of problems that would be solved in the Song of Ice and Fire if people would just shut up and listen for a moment and maybe not be selfish. And I've noticed reading, I saw it a little bit in book one, I see it later in the series, but there's a huge disconnect between the people who rule and the people who are ruled. And I don't know if he addresses this later on, but I see a lot of the populace like suffering, and I'm like, you know what? If I lived in that kingdom, I would get thousands of people together as best I could and just march on the capital city, because these people are treating me like assholes. The mountain is going around raping.
Quell you.
So much rape.
Yeah, there really is.
In that sense, it's actually kind of realistic, though.
So this is something I've heard. You know, everybody says, oh, it's such a brutal world. You know, people could die at any time. There's rape, there's incest, you know, there's murder, people lie. It's very realistic. But the weird thing is, to me, like, yes, those qualities, those, like, unsentimental, ugly, brutal realities are true to our world. But this is also a fantasy world. You know, there's dragons and there's magic. And Daenerys tries to bring her dead husband back to life through sorcery. Like, so it's weird because those ugly, cruel things make you think this is so realistic, but it's actually still set in crazy land, you know? And so things don't necessarily have to be that way. Like the sexism that's kind of inherent in the culture of this world, people are like, well, that's the way it was back then. But it's like, there was no back then. This is a magical world that never existed.
So I find it strange. I correlate it to a medieval type of thing. I picture it not as, this is how it is in the streets of New York right now. I mean, like, when I picture a medieval world with castles and knights, I picture a lot more rape. That's what I was saying. I mean, right? Don't you guys agree?
Well,
a little bit
ultimately,
less, you know, sanctity of life because people don't live as long, you know, those times. That's what I'm talking about.
I kind of see this as a what-if story. What if there were magic in the medieval times? And it hasn't been for the longest time. It's just now starting to come back with the rebirth of the dragons.
Yeah, yeah.
Exactly. Well, exactly. And it's a nice way to explore political possibilities and to tell cool medieval stories, but without pissing off historians.
Right. Yeah. Also, I mean, you know, going to extremes like this helps us to explore the kernels of truth in society today. So when you say, oh, look at all the ruthless assholes being in complete control of the power, you can kind of correlate that to our very day today. I mean, it's not that hard.
The nice thing about the injustice and the political corruption in these stories is that it's not melodramatic. It's not like Joffrey is this a mustache twirling essence of evil. He's not like a Saruman. He's a kid who's perverse and has been spoiled all his life. And so you can see like the corrupting influences that gave him free rein to be such a monster. Like
terrible mothering.
There's no comeuppance for him. So, you know, his evil whims, like, he can just act out all the time.
Exactly. That's how he was raised. He's perfect and can do whatever he wants.
Yeah.
Let's move on to another character, because we spend this much time on each character, this will be a 4-hour podcast. Talk about a great counter character to Ned Stark, Tyrion Lannister. Tyrion is quite the polar opposite, I feel, of Ned Stark. First off, he is physically nothing like Ned Stark. He's a dwarf. He's this short little man who is born with this, I guess you would call it a defect, dwarfism, or whatever you wish to call it. He's raised in the rival household, or one of a household that shares very different beliefs from the Starks. And he gets it. He gets the game. He gets how this world works. And he is a mighty fan favorite, to say the least. Played, obviously, in the show by Peter Dinklage. So I feel like Tyrion is maybe the apology that all this bad shit is happening. It's like, well, I've got to have someone who's, you know, got a good head on their shoulder. What do you guys think about Tyrion?
I see what you did there.
Yeah. Rob, we'll start with you. What do you think about Tyrion?
I love Tyrion Lannister. He's the only good thing to come out of that family. Jaime's starting to get there, but he's very intelligent. He realized at a young age that because of his defects, he was going to have to become smarter than everybody else to get ahead in the world. And so he did. He reads everything he can possibly get his hands on.
He's very cynical and quite hilarious as well.
Yeah.
Pete, what about you?
Well, Tyrion Lannister is... Sorry, I was on mute. Tyrion Lannister is a fantastic character. I think he's one of the best literary creations I've had the pleasure of meeting.
How do you really feel?
He sucks. God. No, what a great character. He's so massively intelligent. He always has the right thing to say. He can talk himself out of getting killed over and over again. And how do you not like that? And then when it's time to man up, he can grab a shield, beat a man to death with it. You know, he goes in the battle with the wildlings or whatever they are, the hill people. Mm-hmm. He's a half man doing everything that a regular man would. And it doesn't matter how they mock him. Doesn't matter. He could still grab his women and grab his wine and go into battle and be as much a man as anybody else.
Is he your, without spoiling anything from the other books, is he your favorite character in the entire series?
No.
Oh.
No, Arya Stark is my favorite character in the entire series.
We'll talk.
That girl. Favorites.
That girl. Oh, that girl. She's going to win it all. She's going to win it all.
They're going to kill her and you're going to be upset. Not only are they going to kill her, they're going to rape her in the worst way.
Yeah, they're going to rape her a lot. Death. You know they are, Pete.
Yeah, probably. But she's going to poison a few of them.
If I could jump in on the Tyrion train, like, one of my favorite characters from Shakespeare is Iago.
Yeah.
Because he's so clever and he's always scheming, and he lets the audience in on his machinations. And I feel like Tyrion has like a real strong Iago Machiavellian streak to him. He's like, I can't have all the great prizes that life should give me, so I'm going to endeavor to be villainous and scheming and find ways to cleverly get what I want. But it's like if you had Iago and you had to stay with him. So like at the end of Othello, Iago gets dispatched and taken away, and it's like, all right, game over. But with Tyrion, you hang out with him for much longer, and so you see him get captured, and you see him have to get into fights, and you see him have heartbreak and stuff like that. And so it's really cool, because he's got this very charismatic, smart, like, nerd avatar edge to him, but then you can hang in there and get some emotional resonance with him as well, where you feel sympathetic towards him, in addition to being impressed with his abilities.
Well spoken.
Well done.
He also doesn't strike me as evil like a lot of the Lannisters do. Like he's genuinely good, you know, in a lot of ways. He's just looking out for himself in the most cynical way possible. That's all.
He's the first person that you see bitch slap Joffrey, and it just makes you so happy. Yep.
So cathartic.
Every time it happens, I do a little cheer.
I really appreciate that he is raised in this vile family. And it's not, you don't find out this out till later, but it's not, all of the Lannister kids are messed up, mainly because Daddy Lannister, because Tywin is a whole interesting thing, and he doesn't come into play till a long time, but none of these kids are messed up for the sake of being evil. And I think Joffrey, I mean, they've kind of alluded to this, but Joffrey's probably screwed up because mom and dad are brother and sister.
Incest.
Womp, womp.
Incest leads to crazy.
Probably why you don't want to do that.
Well, and George,
that's why the Targaryens had so much trouble.
Exactly. Said so as much with the histories. You read in the book, the Targaryens started sleeping with each other. They got all bright blonde and went crazy.
Lavender eyes.
Beautiful purple eyes.
Anything else you guys want to say about Tyrion before we move on?
In this book, he's the only source of comic relief in the entire thing. And it's still brutal and awful, and it's still manipulating and conniving, but at least you get a chuckle in all this madness.
Yeah, he was quite a relief in this book. Ugh, kind of a grim book.
Yeah, any time it's a Tyrion chapter, you know you'll probably get a laugh somewhere and some very interesting wit thrown at you.
Mm-hmm.
Which this book needs in very certain times.
Jamie says some things that kind of make me chuckle here and there, too, and then sometimes make me groan.
True.
They're great brothers. I like their relationship.
I love their relationship.
And how they what kind I thought of reflect was, each other.
What I thought was interesting about the show was when they had the scenes between with all the siblings near the beginning of the first season. And you don't get that in the books. You don't get to establish their resting state. You know, you have the whole family with all of the kids gathered at Winterfell, and they have a nice breakfast together.
How Cersei, Jaime, and Tyrion all talk to each other.
Exactly.
I want to jump back to the Starks and talk about Jon Snow, who is also going through a mystery, and we've kind of mentioned that he might be another character you are meant to identify with. He's going through a much larger mystery of what's affecting the world up north, and this quickly, at least to me personally, through the first book, is something that's going to affect the world very, very harshly if it happens, or whatever this threat is in the north. And I would like to give a prop to George R. R. Martin. I think the concept of the wall is really fascinating, just this structure that stands and literally divides the land and protects it from the frozen horrors that live north of it. It's kind of like the Death Star. Like, when you introduce something like that, like, this wall has never been torn down. It's been up here for thousands of years. As a reader, I think, like, you're saying or you're winking, like, at some point, that wall's gonna get torn down. It's kind of like the Death Star, you know, this thing destroys planets, but it has this one weakness. Like, you know something like that can't exist. Like, something is gonna happen. So, I'm curious about that. But Jon Snow, what do you guys want to say about Jon Snow?
Sometimes too whiny, but generally I like him.
he gives me a little bit of a Luke Skywalker vibe from time to time as far as the whiny goes.
Yeah.
It's almost like too perfect. Like, he's so great at everything. And he's also noble. And he's also humble. You know, he's great. I love Jon Snow. How do you not like him? He's great.
What?
And he kills one of those, you know, walker things, so that's pretty badass.
Texas Rangers. Yes. Ice zombie.
He does kill he a Texas a walker, Ranger. Texas Ranger.
I like him better in the book than in the TV show.
Me too, totally.
In the book, everybody's younger. They're all, like, children.
Right,
and, I like the idea of this, like, preteen or teenager going out to the wall and having to get into scrapes and dangerous situations and learning about himself. Whereas
well, he's 15.
He's 15?
Yeah.
And he's really introverted. So, like, you don't get a lot of that unless you get a voiceover in television. So you just see a picture of this guy with long, dark hair. And you're like, oh, he's thinking deep, somber thoughts.
Yeah.
Whereas in the book, you're like, oh, these are what the thoughts he's thinking.
Were you going to say something else? Like, to me, the actor in the TV show is adequate, but kind of more vacant than the character in the book. And older. And so I don't feel as much empathy for him and his struggle.
Right.
Exactly. They couldn't cast 15-year-olds with squeaky voices.
Throw Daniel Radcliffe in there.
You saw what happened with the Harry Potter movies.
Arya? Arya was
She's aging. They're making it look like she's not aging, but she is.
It's helpful that Jon Snow is in an area that values honor and duty and has respect for that. If he was thrust into the King's Landing scenario, he could very well have ended up like Ned Stark pretty quickly.
Well, he'd have been useless there as a bastard anyway.
True.
Yeah.
But yeah, I totally like that aspect of the Night's Watch, that everything gets wiped clean no matter where you came from, and you're all brothers.
Yeah.
You all say the words.
It's like a really harsh Boy Scouts.
Really? Exactly what it's like.
No sex?
No, it's a good allegory a young man with no future joining the army.
Yeah. It's conscription. No, it's sex. Conscription. Anything else you guys want to say about Jon Snow before we move on?
He's got the coolest wolf.
He does have the coolest wolf.
Oh, the wolf.
We should probably talk about the wolves.
We'll talk about the wolves. But let's talk about someone who we've already mentioned, which is Arya. Yeah.
She's a little
Arya Stark. She is.
You said she's your favorite character. Now, with how she is in the first book, is she your favorite character?
In the first book, no. Ned Stark is my favorite character in the first book, even though he's so stupid. even Arya's smarter and is telling him to watch out, and he's like, no, it's fine. Oh, you heard men talking in a dungeon? Pff, silly girl, nothing to worry about.
What? It was a mama's farce.
Listen to your daughter. Arya's great, and she's just her biggest flaw is she's too young. That's her biggest flaw in the book, is she's just not ready yet.
She's also a girl. That's her problem.
That's her problem.
No one takes her seriously.
Except Ned Stark, who teaches her how to fight. He's like, all right, if you're not going to give this up, I'm going to get you a tutor, so you're going to do it right. And because of that beginning lesson, it allowed her to survive.
It's a really good idea.
Yeah, mm-hmm. She's very tomboyish, very much supposed to be raised, you know, going to be a princess of Winterfell or whatnot, but doesn't want that. Wants to grab a sword and go stab people.
I think she was eventually going to have to end up marrying Catelyn's sister. No. Cousin somebody's son. I don't know. They were going to marry her off down in the Riverlands.
To a Tully.
You know, and I kind of got the feeling that like she was probably the way she was just because Catelyn didn't really lavish too much on her, because she looked more like Ned's side of the family. She looked more like Jon Stark. Or Jon Snow.
Oh.
That's right.
She
wasn't look
girly
alike.
And perfect like Sansa.
Mm-hmm. Right. But the book mentions how strongly they resemble each other.
Yeah.
And Jon also was friendly with her, which couldn't have helped her chances with Catelyn.
Exactly.
Mm-hmm.
Horseface Arya.
That's how they describe Arya her in the book.
Horseface, yeah.
I agree with you, Pete. She still has... I really like her character, but I feel she's a victim, and she's a victim for a long time. And part of that is just circumstance of where she is and her age and being a woman in this
but
world.
She, yes, she's a victim in a lot of it, especially, you know, there's first and second book, there's a whole lot of victim, but all throughout it, she is still a Stark. She's still plotting. Mm-hmm. She still has a sense of justice and still has that sense of, I am not going to stop until I see this wrong righted. And so it's more than just being in the right place at the right time. She made decisions to stay alive. Rather than, she could have charged back in and tried to help her tutor. She could have gone and tried to run directly for her father. She could have done this. She could have done that. But she thought about it. She stayed alive. And I think she's more like Ned Stark than any other character.
I would think that's the exact opposite of Ned Stark.
You're right. It's not, well, I don't know. Because Ned Stark, before he came to King's Landing, when Ned Stark was a young man, he was awesome. And he made all the right decisions.
It's but, like, you know, they have this connection of the sigil animal to the characteristics of the characters. You know, they talk about her being like a direwolf and Ned being like a direwolf in their aspect and their eyes and their demeanor, attitude.
Exactly. And he dotes on her too, even more than Sansa, because he doesn't know what to say to Sansa. He knows how to talk to Arya.
I appreciate the instances where you and this is one thing I think the series is really strong with. The series writes family really well, and I love just seeing family interact in this world. I really only enjoy it between the Starks and Lannisters. Some of the other families just kind of get annoying or just not as interesting to me.
You don't like the Baratheons?
I'm thinking more about the Greyjoys.
The Greyjoys? You don't love the
Greyjoys? God, the Greyjoys. Although I kind of like his sister a lot.
So does
he. In the books. I love her.
They're
in the
all
books.
A little incesty, yeah. Guys. I just got to say. She's a little incesty. Mm-hmm.
What is his sister's name in the book?
I never remember.
It's
D?
Asha. It's Asha. Instead, and the wildling is Osha, and she is Asha Greyjoy. And it was too different, so they changed her name for the series.
Hey, you guys are talking about a different book. Let's just talk about the first book.
Me.
Okay, that's not a spoiler.
So let's move on to a couple of the other Stark children, and then we're going to change gears. Sansa Stark, I feel, is the traditional princess. And a big contrast to Arya, obviously. And another victim, and as much as I find Sansa whiny, she goes through some of the worst. I mean, she is paired with Joffrey. So I just feel bad for her. In both the show and the book, and I think they do the show does Sansa right. Like I don't enjoy watching.
I like her more in the show. Yeah. They give her a backbone in the show. She has none in the books.
That's true.
Yeah, she doesn't. No. Yeah, she is simpering until the very end when she starts to flare up at that scene at the end when she's looking up at her father's head. And she gets beaten for it.
She's doing what she thinks she's supposed to do. I mean, she's fulfilling the role she feels like she's supposed to fulfill. You know, getting married. It's the greatest thing in the world to get married to the future king, right?
Exactly. You can't blame a 14-year-old girl
She's
getting excited about going.
But she's a 14-year-old girl getting...
At some point, you would think, like, as much absolute shit as she goes through, that she would try to change her station in some way, even if it's just trying to escape, because she only relied on other people. She never did anything for herself. She would only rely on other people. So, like, when the drunk said he was going to save her, she was, like, excited. And then, you know, you see a little more life out of her. And then it just gets horrible again.
She's not a very exciting character. No. I agree.
No. And it's a shame. And especially in the first book, there's really not much for Sansa to do except cry at the death of the direwolf,
lots of weeping. Which was her fault anyway. Because she ratted on her sister.
I like Rickon just about as much as I like her, but that's just because nothing's been written about him. He's too young.
Rickon.
Exactly. He's
a wild card.
4 years old.
Yeah.
Sansa, named Wolf Shaggy Dog.
Sansa yeah. is a Disney princess stuck in the world of Game of Thrones.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm.
That's a good
place. Yeah, that's, yeah.
I She's about to burst into song before somebody loses their head.
Except those princesses have backbone.
I don't think that she's a very interesting or compelling character, and you definitely want to skip when you approach one of her chapters.
It's so true.
There is something special there, because the world of Game of Thrones really rewards strength and endurance, mm-hmm. and she's someone who is sensitive and essentially pretty weak, you know, and she's just trying to do what she was taught to do and be a good little girl, and she's in this world that chews up good little girls. And she doesn't just jump from her tower window, you know, even though she she is afraid and she cries to herself and she pouts, like, she endures. And yeah, so
she's
in a
totally
way,
alone
in a way that's like remarkably strong in comparison to like a warrior who gets put in a bad situation, because she was never strong. And yet she has to find that strength.
The scene where she tries to. Oh, shit. Is the scene with her having her period in book one.
Oh, yeah.
Okay, and that was like the signifying factor of when she would be able to marry Joffrey. So yeah. she tried to hide it. And that scene of her trying to like stuff her mattress into the fire, that's one of the favorite Sansa moments.
I mean, who hasn't tried to do that?
I mean, right? This is it's a grim book, I'm just saying.
So we've got three other Stark children. We've got Rickon, who doesn't have a lot really written Skip. About him. And we have Rob. Not you, Rob, but Rob Stark, the eldest Stark. Is he older than Jon Snow?
He is.
Yes.
Okay.
Just barely.
They seem pretty contemporary.
Either a year or
2 years,
I can't remember which.
He is the true heir to Winterfell after Ned. And this isn't much of a spoiler, but obviously he comes in charge after his father is slain.
Yeah, that's kind of a given.
Yeah, it's a given. And I really like Robb Stark. I mean, he doesn't really have a lot in the first book either, so...
I can't remember. Does he become King in the North at the end of the first book, or is it second
book?
That's
later.
That's the beginning of the second book.
No, I think they do bring it up.
I think it's at the end.
It's at the end of the first book.
Yeah, it's like his last chapter. They're like, we don't want any other king but you. You're the King of the North. And he was like, well, all right.
He does take it hesitantly. Like he realizes it'll start a war. I mean, the war's already started.
He said, well, all right.
Okay.
Oh, okay.
This
will work out.
But you get important events with him because they're all back at Winterfell. So you get him, you get Theon, and you get their cool relationship, and you learn about Theon and the Greyjoys. And then you get Bran. I like Bran.
Oh, yeah,
like
Bran.
Bran
is kind of the focus of the mystery that begins at the beginning of the book, as he is pushed out of a tower and becomes a cripple. Dun, dun, dun.
And I'm so glad they kept that line in the show when Jaime Lannister throws him out of the window. This is all the things I do for love.
Oh, yeah. That's a great... Oh, that whole sequence is great.
Yeah. It was... The sex scene was a little more graphic in the book.
I was going to say, it's more tame in the TV show.
Yeah. As much as people complain about the TV show having too much sex, it is nothing compared to the books. The books are way more
events
graphic.
Described in the book, especially regarding the mountain, are so horrific that it makes me sick inside. Yeah, I can't read it. It's horrible.
Do you think the sex in the book is gratuitous, or does it serve a purpose?
I think it serves the purpose of the world. The world is, I take it to be a heightened, horrible world. And that's just how I took it from the beginning, and it's kind of...
Well, a lot of it revolves around Tyrion, too, and, like, some of his main relationships are with a whore, and so I don't think it's too gratuitous. I think it fits very well in the story.
And men who are in battle are, you know, historically noted to do this sort of stuff, and guess what? There's a lot of battle, so there's a lot of rape. Seems like pretty...
Mm-hmm.
You know.
But there are also camps of whores that follow armies around.
Yeah, there's lots of whores as well. Yeah. So there was never a scene where Petyr Baelish is teaching two whores how to pleasure a man by having them masturbate one another and enjoy it. But that was in the television show. So That was interesting.
So the TV makes some important...
It's a very important artistic decision, I think.
I would really like to point out
a lot to me.
We were talking about Bran the Cripple, and now we're talking about Rafe.
As night follows day.
Is there anything else you guys want to say about Bran?
Absolutely.
Dreams.
I could see where you wouldn't like Bran in the first book, because he does, I mean, he does dwell a lot about, he's like, oh, I wanted to be a knight, and now he can't be. I do like that Tyrion Lannister tries to pull him aside and say, hey, you know, don't make this a weakness, make this a strength.
That's a beautiful moment. I love that moment.
Yeah.
And he gives him the harness for his horse.
Yep. Mm-hmm.
Makes him ride again. And he starts having the dreams. And also, he's the guy learning everything. And you don't realize it, but Bran's chapters are where you get the history of the world that he's living in. Everybody else is dealing with acts. Exactly. The old ladies teaching him, the old mentors teaching him, and you're getting all these tidbits and backstories, and he's walking the wildling girl through the tombs and describing the ancient Starks, and he's all about describing the world, because he's stuck at home. That's his only thing to do.
There's one Stark we haven't talked about, and that's Catelyn, Ned's wife. There is a lot
she's
of hate.
She's a Tully.
Uh-huh. Yeah, oh, sorry, yes. There is a lot of hate for her, and I don't know if the hate comes later on or if it's in the first book. I really like her.
I was going to say, I don't know why somebody would hate her. She really persecutes Jon Snow, but it is a living reminder that her husband did sleep with someone else.
Yeah.
So, I mean, I get it.
We can overlook that. You know, that's not that bad.
Pete, what were you going to say?
The exact same thing that Rob said. I can see people hating her because of her treatment of Jon Snow, and also because she is a little too overprotective of her children. And considering how harsh the world is, you can understand that too. But when it comes to her older children, she's a little too clingy, and I think especially later it gets Rob in trouble, but.
I think later it gets. I like that moment between them later on where he stands up to her, and she realizes, oh, my boy's actually a king.
Yeah, and then he makes the wrong decision. But whatever.
I think
should have listened to her, but still,
she can easily fall into the nagging wife stereotype. But I feel sometimes her nagging is actually coming from a very insightful place. Of course. Ned is dead after the first book, and then she becomes a widow, which can also be annoying. So,
she had one of my favorite moments in the first book when the assassin comes for Bran in the bed
and fights him off.
She grabs the blade. I cringed I read that.
Yeah,
she grabs the blade of the knife with her hand.
Yeah,
yeah. I love that. I love that whole scene where the direwolf just bursts in and saves them both.
I love her taking Tyrion captive and dragging him to the Sky City. And yeah, I love that.
I want to shift gears away from the Starks and talk about one major plot line we haven't talked about, which is the Targaryens. Separated, and people, I was warned about this before reading the first book, that this was a series that dared to set plot lines up in very distant parts of the world. And this is not a big spoiler, but there is no interaction with what's going on with Daenerys and what happens.
There is.
In the first book? Yes,
in
there
the
is.
In the first book,
there is very small events. It's very important.
Yep.
What are
small
they?
Events. We already mentioned one of them when Arya is down with the dragon skulls. And that is Illyrio talking.
Illyrio of Pentos.
Yeah, who was taking care of the Targaryen siblings.
Okay.
Talking
Robert
to
Baratheon
Spider.
Put an extermination order out on Dany, and that got a little farther than, you know, Ned would have liked. Before Ned could stop it, they had already sent the assassin, the cask of wine.
Yeah.
Definitely the assassin, although it's a very small thing. Like, she already doesn't like Westeros. I mean, an assassin coming to kill her by the usurper is just going to make him not like her even.
She loves Westeros. She wants to rule it.
Right. Yes. She wants to get the usurper off the throne. She doesn't. It makes her not love the usurper anymore.
Right.
That's what I mean. Yeah, Daenerys.
A thin connection for sure. Yeah.
Yeah. It's. Yeah. Yeah. Aside from that, the.
However, that event does lead her to, because it wasn't a real threat from across the sea. The usurper was there and he was going to stay there and whatever. We don't have to worry about him until we go home. Now all of a sudden she's being attacked at home.
And her husband wants to go do something about it.
Exactly. And now her husband is on the warpath going, okay, you want to mess with my wife? I will build 10,000 ships and sail across the sea and take your iron chair.
Yeah, the story of Daenerys is, at least what I've experienced so far, so interesting in the first book, mainly because of her brother and then dealing with this culture of the Dothraki. And I love the guy that's playing Khal Drogo in the show. Like, I think the relationship is really cool. Obviously, there's a lot of sex gratuitous sex, but... I really believed their love by the end of the book and by the end of the show.
Oh, yeah.
So when I was actually really sad when he died in the book.
Sucked.
It was really heartbreaking, and it really shifts her whole game plan. That shifts everything. What do you guys want to say about Daenerys?
She's one of my favorite characters. And one of my most hated characters at the same time. I love her growth. She goes from this meek little nothing to a dragon. She's a Targaryen by the end of it, more than her brother. But then I get frustrated, and this has nothing to do with this particular book, but later on she just drags her feet. To the point, and I think George R. R. Martin's come out and said he has no clue what he wants to do with her.
Interesting.
As of right now.
Damn it, George.
Here's my problem, like with the first book in general, that I think Daenerys her story is a good example of. For my money, as a consumer of stories, there are just too many things going on in one book. I think that if he had, divvied up this into several books, this is the book of the Starks, this is the book of the Targaryens, this is the book of the Lannisters, that would have been
I don't
much...
think I would have liked it as much.
That's fair. My thing is, Daenerys, as we mentioned, has very little interaction with the world of Westeros, so it's sort of like you're reading a completely separate book set in the same universe at the same time. But I felt that disconnect most profoundly between jumping from a Westeros story to her story. I was like, who cares about what she's doing? She's not part of this war, at least not yet. And so to me, it felt unnecessary. Relevant, but unnecessary.
Have you read book two? Just curious.
No, I've only watched the TV shows after I read the first book.
Oh, okay. And just season one, right?
No, all the seasons so far.
I haven't
watched all of the season one, weirdly enough.
Okay, got it.
So Mark brings up some things that I want to kind of talk about. So Mark brought up the issue of George R. R. Martin essentially juggling many balls in the air, many plot threads. I'm kind of in the halfway between this. That doesn't really bother me. There are some plot threads that are very small that it kind of feels weird to introduce them so early because you get no information about it. But what really bothers me, and it's the length of the book, honestly. Like, I think he can tell just as good a story and significantly shorter. I think he can just be more concise, honestly. Is it a good thing if you get to a chapter with a character and your first inclination is, can I skip this? Is that a good thing? I would argue it's probably not. I don't know. I honestly think the books are too long for their own good. And he doesn't... I love the character focus per chapter. I love the grand story. I like the world. but it is a slog to read these books, and he doesn't have the problem that Tolkien does, where Tolkien describes every facet of a door. I feel...
And then doesn't describe his characters?
And then doesn't describe his characters. It's just, I do feel his books are too long, and I'm definitely the first person that'll say, you know what? Watch the show. I think the show is as good, if not better, than the books. George R. R. Martin had input on the show, and some of the revisions and changes are because of him in the show, because he wrote the book, you know, like 15 years ago. So I just threw a huge amount of crap at the wall. What do you guys think about what I said? Mark, you're my outcast, so let me start with you. Is this book too long?
Yeah. It's too long there, boss.
It's too long. Now, did you say you had read Lord of the Rings?
I read the first book of Lord of the Rings.
Okay. We're kind of going back to Martin as a writer. If his book's too long, like what is it that's too long? Is he just too repetitive with certain characters? Is he too descriptive? Is it too much violence and rape? Like, what is it?
I think there's a few elements. The first, which I've already complained about, is all the different stories going on simultaneously. You know, there's not like two main characters that he's following. There are many characters of significance that he's following, and each one of them has their turn in the spotlight. And, like, frankly, I think that's just too many. My opinion, like, I write, I'm not a professional writer, but I write, and I feel like the writer has a obligation to the audience to be compelling and to be, you know, succinct and not indulgent. And if you are writing many, many, many threads, you have to make sure that each of them is really, really compelling if you want to hold the audience's attention. And I feel that George R. R. Martin is perhaps so invested in world building that he loses the consideration for his audience. And he says, you'll stay with me. I know that you want to find out what happens, so you'll indulge me. But I think that that's unfair to the reader. So I think that his world building is cool, but if he wanted to, he could have told one or two stories with his first book and then come out with, you know, here's the omnibus, or here's the guide to my world, if you're really that into it. So for a first book out, I feel like he throws out too many stories and then doesn't finish any of them, or doesn't resolve major problems that he's set up. The other thing, Tolkien had his description of landscapes. George R. R. Martin focuses on clothing and food.
Food.
Yeah, and that's unnecessary. You don't need to tell me. Just say there was a feast. You don't need to tell me there was...
No, I absolutely disagree. I 100% disagree with that last statement.
Are you a hobbit?
Go ahead, Pete.
No, in ways, yes. Yes, I am. The favorite parts of all the books are when he takes the time to describe food to me. Because you know what? And it's not just because I'm a fat guy. Yeah, I'm a fat guy, whatever. Hemingway did the same thing. He takes the time to describe how things smell, how they taste, what they sound like. He describes the environment. You're not just in a room. You're in a cell. It's dank. It's smelly. What does it smell of? Why does it smell that way? What is in that corner? Good God, what is in that corner? What are the guards talking about? And, you know, I like having that set up. It really delves me into that world. And to answer another point that you were saying, Mark, I'm sorry, guys. Answer another point you were saying, Mark. He was a TV studio writer at the time. He wrote the first book, and he was so frustrated at Hollywood and TV not producing anything that he wrote, that he wrote a book that could never be turned into a movie or a show. That was his goal.
Huh.
Yeah. That's funny.
So perhaps you're all correct that it was a little self-indulgent, I guess, is the point of that.
Yeah. And also,
and that's okay. I mean,
his audience.
Yeah, he wanted to tell a certain kind of story. Plus, if you know everything a guy ate later in the day when he gets disemboweled by a crossbow bolt, you know exactly what it's all about.
There's a real payoff.
Yeah, there's a real payoff.
There's the corn.
Like, set up and then knocking them down.
Rob, I'll
agree a little bit with one of the things you said, Mark. I think he does
probably, because he's even added characters now that have their own point of view. I think it's too many, to the point, because we even addressed it earlier, sometimes I'll hit a chapter and it's a character I absolutely hate, and I'll think, man, I could just skip this, but then there's going to be something in there that I need to know.
Yeah. To learn something from someone.
Yeah.
That'll be important.
Yeah, any Cersei Lannister, any Sansa Stark, I seriously contemplated not reading it.
You had to read the Sansa chapters because she's right next to the king, and you know.
Yep. Exactly, that's where you get the Joffrey action, that's where you get the...
learn
the,
about Joffrey, and
the Littlefinger, you get to hate him so exquisitely. Littlefinger and the spider, you get all
there are other characters the around them, yes, but that may just be that I hate the characters, I don't know, so...
Well, you're in their head. You're listening to their thoughts. So Sansa's petty little bullshit about her dress is kind of like, hey, people are dying, like, just outside the walls. Starvation, you dumb bitch.
I guess one of my things with that is, like, and I think this may be why they started giving Cersei her own chapters, was, like, because Sansa and Tyrion were the two that were that aspect of the story that you were getting, you know, through their point of view. And when Sansa leaves... And when Tyrion leaves, I think that's probably why they gave Cersei her own stuff, is so that you had that point of view in that area at time. But man, I just hate these characters.
Yeah, I hated when I got inside Cersei's, I hated it. Because the first time I read it, I was like, no way. I've got to live inside this character's head. Yeah. And then by the end of the book, I liked her a little bit. I could see it from her
perspective. Seriously? Man, I hated her even more.
No, I despise her.
No, she deserves everything that she's getting. But, you know. You don't. Do you want?
Jamie's
to see
the only one that so far in that group that has like started to redeem himself for me.
And oh no, and she's guys, shown
hold on, hold on, hold on, hold on. We may have strayed away from the first book.
We have definitely
totally have.
Yeah,
I'm sorry.
So, I want to. How do you guys respond to? Do you think the books are too long? And I mean, it's not just the first book. I've heard this criticism levied against all of them. Is there such a thing as too long of a book?
I don't think so, because I'm always upset when I hit the end of it.
Me too.
Mm-hmm. So I'm going to say no. I don't mind long books. I actually kind of enjoy them because I really enjoy reading. It's kind of escapism for me. So when I hit the end of a book, I'm a little upset. And I also know that I've got another fucking 5 years to wait.
Ugh, that's the worst part.
So I was upset when I finished the end of this book as well. But partially because I had gone through that really long journey and still had no release. There was no catharsis for me where it's like, building action, oh my God. You know, it felt like the whole thing was a big prologue, and I felt really disappointed. I felt angry at George R. R. Martin. As I mentioned, I felt swindled. And
Go ahead.
The characters he makes are cool, and I think his world is cool. But as I mentioned, I feel that there is an obligation to the audience. We engage in these entertainments to feel something and walk away from the experience a little bit different. And I didn't have that catharsis after the first book.
I did actually after the first book, just because I got the payoff of the dragons at the end. That moment for me when she burns Khal Drogo's body, steps into the flames with the eggs. Yeah. And is not killed. It was one of the coolest moments in that entire book. I was actually made me want to just pick up the next book, and I did, and see, you know, where's this going now. I loved that moment.
Does anyone know when they were released? Because I think book two came out pretty swiftly after book one. Like that particular wait wasn't talking. Very long. The only reason I ask is just because I do agree. Book one is not as fulfilling, despite, I agree, the Daenerys dragon thing is quite awesome. Becoming the mother of dragons and everything she went through with her whole baby becoming some sort of aged, mummified demon baby. Horrible. Just horrible.
Well, that's just what the ancient lady said. Nobody saw it except for her.
Well, I thought it was disfigured.
You
she
could
got a
hear
glimpse.
The demon.
Oh, okay.
You hear it. Okay. Or shadows on the inside of the tent or something like that. I have
a hypothetical question that I want to pose to my experts. And I'm going to try and do this in the most non-spoiler way that I can. And please answer in a very non-spoiler way if you can.
Mm-hmm.
There has been a lot said about George R. R. Martin, nobody is safe. No character is safe in this world. And it's one of the things he's known for. The death of Ned Stark, while tragic, really is memorable, and it's ballsy. It's ballsy to take perhaps the protagonist of the book and have them lose and kill them and take them out of the story. Is there a point where it's too much? And I'm going to put this in a... Let me throw this out there. Let's take...
As Martin. A quick aside...
Sure.
The first book came out in 96, the second book came out in 98.
Cool. Okay. That's a quick turnaround.
Not too bad.
So here's my hypothetical. Let's take a character like Arya, who is a huge fan favorite, and hopefully is building to something cool. What if he gives her the most miserable, degrading, rapey death he possibly can? Because this is a realistic world, and that is a possibility. Will you feel gypped as a reader? Is that
to Mark's point? I would totally feel, because yes, you are right. You do set up a relationship as the author and the reader, and you kind of set up some expectations. And though he has stripped us of beloved characters, I do believe there are some people who are safe, I guess, in my mind. You know, I think Arya is one of them. Does anyone else agree with me about that?
I fully believe she could die. But I think she is going to accomplish something big before she does, in the process.
Yes. If she dies ignominiously, yes, I'd be horribly pissed off. But she will certainly, at the very least, do something amazing before she dies. I mean, because that would be ridiculous. Why would you spend so much time building her up in this way, you know, and growing her as a person, teaching her?
I think Sansa is going to have something big to do with the book.
Otherwise, she's
even in the series.
Yeah, she better get her shit together too, because come on, she's at the heart. Never mind, we're not talking about anything.
Maybe Sansa is the character who you think is important, and then nothing important ever happens to. Maybe at the end of the book, at the end of the series, she gets to go marry a Disney prince.
Probably that's what happens.
That's not that far fetched.
Rob, Pete, what about you two? Is there a line that he can cross for you, or is that the appeal of these books? There is no line.
Without saying too much, he conceivably could have already crossed a line. There is one character that goes through all five books and then dies. Well, you think he's dead. We're not 100% sure. Who is somebody I was fairly certain was going to have something big to do with this world.
Okay.
And I still think he might, but...
You know, back to what I said before, I can't believe it just based on the fact that that would be such a betrayal of the author-reader relationship. You know what I'm saying?
And the lives he's taken...
The same way I felt all through book two with the kids.
The lives he took in even the first book, just to stay in the first book, they, even when they were brutal and horrible, they were there to serve a purpose in the story. And so having a character like Arya, as important as Arya or as important as Bran, to have them just cast away and forgotten in a ditch
would definitely piss me off.
Would infuriate me, yes.
So they're safe to a degree, I think. They're not going to, you know, go the way of some guy who has his dog eat his face off in the middle of the night.
It's not like somebody's just going to randomly catch an arrow at the end of a battle.
But that would be the ballsy, realistic thing to do.
It would.
Wouldn't it, though?
All right. It was just a hypothetical question. I was curious to see how you would all react. Let me check in with my outcast.
Ah!
How you doing, my outcast?
Pretty good. My outcast.
Oh.
That's evil emperor.
Yeah, we don't need that.
Welcome to the podcast.
So, I mean, you've already read the book and you've already seen the show. So, I mean, Martin got you. He got your $11.90.
He got my money.
He got your money.
Yeah.
HBO got your money.
Yeah. Got your money.
How do you feel about the show?
I like the show.
Okay.
I only saw the first half of the first season, but I've watched every other season since then. My friend described Game of Thrones as a soap opera, and I think that's fairly accurate. It's a story about families and love and struggle, and that lends itself particularly well to television. I think, as I mentioned, characters that don't matter, they don't dwell on in TV, so you don't have to worry about them. And there's cliffhangers all the time, so I think the show is a really great version of the Game of Thrones world. I was struck when I watched, because I saw season two before I went back and watched season one, I was struck by like how the production value got way better. Like in season one, they have a tournament, and in the book, it seems like this giant grand affair.
It's and a ring fair.
Yeah, in the show, it's so weak. It's like a hallway of dirt and two benches, and they're watching.
Three extras.
That's true.
But I enjoy the show.
Yeah, I mean, I've already gone on record and said I prefer the show actually to the book, and part of that is perhaps maybe the casting. I think the casting is pretty spot on and damn impressive for all the actors that they got.
And if you don't like the mountain, just wait a season. He'll be different.
He'll be a different mountain in the season. My experts, what do you feel about the show? And would you recommend the show over the book?
Yes, just because I have pissed a couple of people off by recommending these books and not telling me it takes 5 years to put a book out. I would say stick with the show because I have a feeling the show's going to finish before the books do.
Yeah, I would recommend the show. It's accessible. You have really good performances by very talented people. And most of all of them are very talented. And so you care, and the stories are being written by talented people, and you have a great team on the entire thing.
Just to jump on that real quick, who are the writers for the show? Are they people handpicked by Martin himself? Because I'm curious. The writing is really good. The adaptation is very interesting.
The majority of it is done by D.B. Weiss and what's his face? Anyway, it's the majority is the two producers. They do a great deal of the directing, and they do a great deal of the writing. But they also outsource certain episodes to different people, and as far as direction and writing goes. But the grand
one episode every year.
Yes, he gets one episode a season.
Chris, I gotta say, I don't think I would necessarily recommend the show over the book. It just depends on who I'm recommending it to. I think the book is way more rewarding. Because you get way more into the world. The television show was fun, but, I mean, my gosh, the book was evocative. I got really wrapped up. And, yeah, book one is not the best example of it because I was really frustrated. But I could go immediately on to book two, which is all of you also can. So that's all I'm
saying. That is important.
It is really helpful because book two makes it, you get a better idea of what the world is going to be like. There are parameters. It's not completely anything goes.
All right.
But yeah, if you don't want to put in the work, because it's a lot of work, and it's ugly work. It's grim work reading those books sometimes, you know.
As a real quick aside, did you guys notice the reverse spoiler that people of the TV show got?
Yes.
At the end of the last season?
Yes.
Something that hasn't been in the books yet?
It's amazing. I'm like, what? Why? Yeah, they're starting. Well, that's going to happen more and more. Apparently, yeah. I read something that said George R.R. Martin is going to allow the television show to continue in storyline, despite the fact that it might be in books he has not yet published.
Yep. Huh.
Not that it'll be a different story, but it might. This has never happened, as far as I know, where the television show actually gets caught up to the book series and then surpasses it so that it can finish before all the actors are, you know, 30 years older. Or however long it takes them to write the rest of the series.
My Arya, you've grown.
I can still hold this weapon.
Bran, you have a full beard.
It doesn't help that he takes forever to put out a book. What's the longest gap between books that he's done?
Five, 6 years? Are we on six years now?
Five and a half, yeah.
Five and a half. Oh.
I think we're about to hit it, though. I think he's about to surpass himself.
Yes, this is going to be the longest.
And he's not a spring chicken, is he?
No, he's not. He's not.
He hates when you ask him that, too.
He gets mad.
Has he put out other things, like, in between these books?
Some television shows.
He worked on Wild Cards. He does books. Anthologies. Like, I don't know if you guys have ever read the Wild Card series, which I would highly recommend. But he's written some of that. He's put the anthologies together. So, yeah, he does other things as well.
Anyone read those two little short stories that are predate the Game of Thrones?
I talked to somebody that has. I have not read them. I didn't know they existed until I was speaking to somebody just recently.
They're fun. They're about when the Targaryens are still in power, like 200 years before the action of Song of Ice and Fire. What are they called?
Neat. It's probably called A Poem of Fire.
The Hedge Knight is one of them, and The Sworn Sword is the other one.
Yeah.
My outcast, do you have any other questions, comments, anything we've mentioned that you want to talk about? Something rattling around in that brain of yours?
Well, I do have a comment, an observation that we haven't talked about. One thing I appreciate about this first book is the way that George R.R. Martin finds ways to champion literacy. There are characters like Tyrion, as Rob mentioned, he reads everything he can. You find him early in the or late at night reading in the library. Sam is like super impotent and afraid and sensitive, but he can read and he can write, and that becomes a strength and a rare gift.
Maesters.
So the maesters. There's much that's made of like the specialness of literacy. And I think that's kind of cool. It's a little like self-congratulatory, like, hey,
authors
reader.
Talking about how great authors are.
Yeah. Hey, reader, you're a great kid for reading. Keep it up. But I mean, also, I think that's a totally legit message, and I'm glad that he addresses it in different ways.
It's weird that Sam is reading a Game of Thrones in the world of Game of... No, I'm kidding.
He's like, I can't wait to buy the next copy.
Oh, shit, I die.
Aww.
Probably.
My experts, is there anything that we haven't touched on that you want to talk about at this time? The floor is open.
Indeed, there is.
I'm sorry. Want to talk about the children real quick? It's not a lot to say because we don't know much. They address the children. The children. The old, the green people from ages past, the age of heroes.
They barely even talk about them in the first book.
It's one of the stories that old Nan tells Bran.
She tells him a lot of stories about...
There's so much we could... I guess we never really discussed what the wall was up for, did we?
No, let's talk about that.
No. No, but
these really freakishly long seasons.
Years-long seasons are amazing.
Yeah, years-long summers.
Decades-long winters.
Yeah. There must be some, and they don't sound like they are... consistent, so I wonder what kind of rotation this thing has around the sun.
I know, it's constantly wobbling. It's really fascinating to think about it.
But I guess thousands of years ago, there were these, I'm assuming undead creatures called the Others, the White Walkers.
Yeah, and the level 12 ice zombies.
There you go. That are coming back. And that is one of the things that I got a little frustrated with in the first book, because the first chapter set that up. And then they don't talk about it again.
Ever again.
Nope.
Nope. Just a long
time. I was like, this is going to be awesome.
I don't know if this is just my own particular point of view going into it, but it seems like a climate change sort of situation where you're watching the political struggles of these people in their own like kind of self-centered lives. And all the while, the writing is on the wall like, hey, the worst winter ever is coming. And these people are raising from the dead, and we need to send help. And they're like, yeah, we got to have a little political fight right now. And you're like, this is a bigger problem than any of you can deal with. We need all the humans to help, and they're not going to help until it's too late. It seems like that is what's in the cards for this world.
It does.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah. I have a fear, and I get the sense, even from the first book, I have a fear that the entire thing will end, and there will be no one living. Like, no character.
So they're just all dead.
Like, he'll kill like, everybody?
Literally no one is safe.
He somehow figures out a way to make a nuclear bomb in the Middle Ages.
The ice zombies jump into the dragon's throat and create some kind of inversion, and everyone's dead.
I like that.
They build an ice Death Star.
Spoiler alert.
Gentlemen, any final thoughts on Game of Thrones? And Tom, we'll start with you. Any final thing you want to say about the show or the first book?
Yeah, absolutely. Okay. I really like the first book about as much as I like the first chapter of the first book. And they're very similar in structure. You know, you get to really know these people at the very beginning of the book, and they all die. And then at the end of the first book, you lose some people that, you know, you became fond of. And like that first chapter, there are other chapters in the book. So there's more to the story. So moving on past book one was my favorite part of book one. But it trapped me. I mean, like, I was sold on this storytelling method, the, you know, first person imperfect perspective, all different first person imperfect perspectives from across the world. I mean, that really was rich to me, and I really enjoyed trying to keep track of it. It was very evocative and horrible at times. Like, I had not read some of the stuff ever before reading some of his chapters. Like, he's able to spin some graphic words together, you know?
Yeah.
But yeah, I really enjoyed it. So book one.
Cool. Pete?
I would like to mention the religions in the book as far as final thoughts. I think having multiple fleshed out religions all around the world really adds a lot of character to each region and gives you a lot of base as to what their values are.
Rob?
As a final thought, I would just say if somebody's out there on the fence as to whether or not to get into the series or not, if you enjoy intricate stories with very, like, well-crafted, fleshed-out characters, give it a try. It's it'll probably suck you in just like it did us. Then you'll have the same frustrations we do. But it's, I would say, give it a try if you are into that kind of thing. Otherwise, just watch the show.
Cool. Mark, any final thoughts?
Yeah, it's pretty good if you're in jury duty for a month. the show is pretty kick-ass, so if you have a limited attention span like myself, just watch the show.
Great. Thank you so much.
Yeah.
All right. Well, I think we're well past the hour mark, and some of us unfortunately have to go to bed. Others have to eat dinner, so we could talk about this for another 2 hours, but we have to bring it to a close. Don't worry. There will be other Game of Thrones / Clash of Kings / Storm of Swords discussion. I would recommend, dear listener, go read the book if you have the time, or if you want some really great acting, watch the show, or if you have no time for this at all, watch the honest trailer for Game of Thrones. Because it's really great. Mark, we'll start with you. Is there anything you need to plug, sir? Any other, anything you're working on? Now's the time.
Yeah. As I mentioned, I write for a podcast called Our Fair City. It's a science fiction, post-apocalyptic, kind of campy story. We're entering our sixth season soon, in the winter. And I also do my own comedy podcast, which Chris has guested on, called Blast Roll Podcast. So please check that out. In the next week, I'll be dropping a new episode all about volcanoes and earthquakes.
My experts, do you have anything that you wish to plug at this time?
Well, I would just like to make it clear that Greg Bear's book that I referred to in my introduction is called Infinity Concerto. Infinity Concerto. It's very good. You should read that. I'm plugging Greg Bear.
All right.
You're plugging Greg Bear?
Yeah.
You know a Greg Bear?
Oh.
Greg Bear.
Pete, what about you?
No, I don't have anything to plug right now, but thank you. Thank you for letting me try.
And Rob?
No, thanks.
What's your
guys,
Xbox
we
handle,
need
bro?
To do things.
Awesome. It's such a pressure-filled question.
Well, now you know how George R. R. Martin feels.
Yeah.
Do you want to write that book, George?
I can't wait.
Because he's watching the Bears game right now?
Oh, God, George, write it. Get your fucking pen out and write the book.
You
just killed a character right there. You just killed a character.
I'm curious.
I really love Cersei.
I'm curious how he writes. I'm just curious what his writing process is. Obviously, it takes a long time, but I'm curious what it is. I wonder if he has a huge chalkboard or whiteboard with just
well,
like, connections.
Well, in his defense, it's become quite complex. There are a lot of characters and a lot of interests being thought through, so I can understand him being kind of confused, but 6 years is a long time.
Yeah, if you don't have a day job, you can pound that shit out in 6 months.
But he's busy with the TV show, which is
well, that's true.
All right, guys. Well, thank you so much for coming out and speaking to Game of Thrones. This has been a very interesting podcast. I feel that we kind of jumped into reader-author relationships, but I enjoyed that. So if you have any questions, comments, or protests, you can email them to nerdoutcastpodcast@gmail.com. I have been your host, Chris Bashan, and joining me today to talk about George R. R. Martin's Game of Thrones have been...
John Brown.
Pete Foose.
Rob Shoemate.
Hodor. Mark Soloff. Thank you, and have a good night.